I always made a promise to myself that if I ever fly into the Flathead Valley and I'm not excited, I'd reconsider. And in the X number of years I've lived here, I've yet to have that. I still get excited when I fly into that airport.
Welcome to Friends of Build Magazine. I'm your host, Ted Bainbridge. I've been traveling the world and working in publications for 30 years. In 2016, we launched our first issue of Build Magazine, a publication dedicated to high-end home construction, renovation, and the innovative experts that make this possible. This podcast was created to have some fun and explore those who have taken on the challenge of building luxury homes in demanding locations. From navigating logistics and construction to excavating the earth, we want to learn more about these people and how their projects became cover-worthy. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. This podcast went a little bit longer because James has got so many incredible stories that you will greatly appreciate. So hang in there, because the pearls and the wisdom of this guy who has traveled all over the world, built and restored several major businesses, will be worth the hour and 15 minutes you're about to spend with him. Make sure you take some notes, because this is not just something to listen to. This is something to learn from. All right, welcome to another episode of Friends of Build Magazine. I am here with James Dodkin from Montana Build. I gotta tell you, I've been so amped up. My assistant Laura says, "Dad," because we normally only deal with the owners, the visionaries. She goes, "Dad, you cannot wait to talk to this guy. He is so interesting. He started so much stuff. He loves and lives the American dream." So don't fall on your face, mate. But
I know, right?
That's right. And then Dan Singer, my partner up in Whitefish, goes, "Oh, man, you've got to talk to James." So I am stoked to do this.
Me too. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, we'll have fun.
Yeah.
So I've been to Edinburgh. I thought I would hate it. I thought it was going to be an absolute dump. It was going to be dreary. My wife and I loved it. We would go back in a heartbeat.
Good. Yeah, I loved it. I did. I loved it so much so I stayed after my undergraduate. I did my postgraduate there. And then a few years later, I went back and started a business there. It's a fun town.
It is a fun town. Love the Red Squirrel, which you've probably been to.
Yep. And the Botanist, the gin distillery there. That's a good little local hangout.
Yeah, there was a fish and chips joint. I think it was called Birdie's.
Yeah, down on the Royal Mile. Yeah, just underneath the castle that's up on the hill up there. It's idyllic. And you're surrounded by water on 2-3 sides there, so you know it's fresh.
Yeah, no doubt. Chippies, as they like to call
Chippies. Yeah, you know, that and curry sauce with my chips is probably one of the things I miss most about the UK.
Okay. I thought maybe Bushnell's maybe one of the things that you miss.
Yeah, there's that. You know, pretty much Indian food and tepid, warm beer.
Yes. Okay, so we kind of started in the middle of this. We'll get to all that. Laura was so excited. She goes, "Dad, this guy, you'll talk to him forever. I mean, he's got such an interesting background." So, so you're born in the Flathead, and then you go to the UK for school.
Yep.
And your roommate is a kid from the Flathead.
From Angel Point on Flathead Lake. You couldn't write it.
Wow. Was that by fluke or was that?
Yeah, it really was. So, like you said, Ted, I was born here in the US and then at the age of 7, moved to the UK for the first time. And I tell this always the same way. I moved from Montana to a boarding school which resembled Hogwarts before even that book was even written. I was wearing a tie and a red striped blazer and gray shorts and knee-high socks. I had a cape that I had to wear. Everyone spoke funny. Everyone played cricket and this game called football, which just was one ball and jumpers for goalposts. It was a bit of a hard landing there, I won't lie. But growing up and going to school in Cambridge, which is about an hour north of London, it's kind of where my folks, who are both English, they always envisage me going to school there. And so I went through from the age of seven all the way through my junior high and high school career, as it were, going to boarding school in the UK, and then coming back to the Flathead Valley for summers and winters. It was a bit of a bizarre existence.
Yeah, so I grew up in Toronto, and I've been to every state and every province. We've been all over the world. But when I was a kid, there's two states I never thought I'd get to, Wyoming and Montana. So for you going from Montana, which is a bizarre experience, to go to private, snotty, upper crust, you know, flick your nose up at everybody because they're not good enough boarding school, especially in the UK, I just keep thinking of Oliver Twist. Why? Now that's probably dates me. Maybe I should say Harry Potter. I don't know.
No, Oliver Twist. Maybe not. Maybe I'm in between. Let's be kind to me. Maybe let's put us in between. But I was going to college when J.K. Rowling was writing those books. So I'm one of the people who claim to fame that I worked next to her in a coffee shop, but I'm sure I didn't.
Yeah, of course.
Of course.
Okay. So what is, and we're going to, I mean, there's a whole, this conversation is going to take so many twists and turns, I know. But what is the difference between growing up in America, and I know you're only here part-time, but you are an American, and mm-hmm. growing up in the UK, the culture, the attitudes, the processes, what's the difference?
They're endless. We'll start with the space. So Montana, the UK or England in particular, fits into Montana seven times. The
what?
Country of England fits into the state of Montana. The
population, and there's 55 million people in Britain, in England, yeah. In England, right?
Yep, 70 on those islands, and what are we, just blipped over a million in Montana here?
Yeah.
And so the first thing was there was this sense of space that I took for granted out here. And you know, I get there and everything's scaled down. The cars are smaller, the houses are smaller, the people are smaller. And you're there and you're on top of everyone. And what that does is, most houses are terraced houses, so you're sharing a house next door on each side of you. And so that goes on until you're very much upper middle class, and then if you can, you'll branch out and get maybe quarter of an acre, and that will be huge for the UK. And so when we went to the UK, my first house for the first 3 years was a townhome in an estate with absolutely no grass and no garden in a town called Royston, just outside of London. And it was a shock. You're playing on the street. You're there, but you're in it with everyone else. And so there's
definitely... So you don't know any different?
They don't know any different, but I came from a huge amount of space and playing and in Flathead Lake to coming to this basically an environment where everyone's on top of each other. Everyone knows each other's business. And if you progress in life in the UK and you maybe move out of that estate, people vilify you. It's not necessarily... I think the biggest cultural thing I've noticed is that people celebrate people's victories over here to some degree.
Oh, yeah.
And over there, it's, now you're part of them. Now you're leaving us. Okay. And you will actually lose touch with people when you leave that environment. And so it was a shock in that respect. And as you know, Ted, everyone in Montana, or mostly, is so friendly and welcoming.
They have to be. If you get stuck in the cold, you need friends.
You've hit on something really, I think, that's integral to the culture between the two, which is we're all in it for winter. And we're in it for 5-6 months of cold, dark snow on the ground. You're checking in on neighbors. If the power's out, you're calling or walking around, taking the snow machine round to check on folk. There isn't that pressure, environmental pressure in the UK. And so really there isn't that, I call it like camaraderie that you have over there. The camaraderie comes depending on what soccer team you follow or what town you grew up in. That's your camaraderie. And you'll know this, that the accent in the UK changes pretty much every 30 miles.
Yeah.
And that is, I found out that that is as far as they used to be able to travel on horseback in a day. So your accent would determine and let everyone else know where you're from.
Oh, I didn't know that. It makes sense. I didn't know that.
It does. And your accent acts as a safety, but it can also vilify you or really alienate you. And so when someone in the UK opens their mouth, you know exactly where they're from, almost to within 10 or 15 miles. I still see people in the US. I saw some people under the Big Sky today. They were English. And I was like, oh, what part of East London are you from? And they just said straight away. And my friends who are American next to me are like, how would you know that? Why would you start the conversation like that? But you know whether they're in West Ham or East Ham or Notting Hill, which is still in London, but you're just across town. But it absolutely delineates you.
Okay, so my wife is off camera. She's listening to this conversation. Her grandparents are from Scotland. I mean, look at me. Obviously, I'm English and Scottish. So she's sitting there, and I hear this gasp or this giggle or this hush. You know, she puts her hand over her mouth, listening to your stories. Oh, my
God. Yeah. Well, let me put it to you this way. I learned this the hard way. When I went to college up in Scotland, I played rugby. I've played rugby since the age of 7. The first week I ever moved to the UK, they put you in some short shorts and some metal-studded cleated boots. And no gum shield, no cup, nothing. Can you start playing rugby? Well, I played that all the way through my master's degree. Well, my first week I get to Scotland, and I'm very English. I have an English accent from Cambridge, like people know. And I got on the rugby team, and the one piece of advice my coach gave me was like, when we play Scottish teams, keep your mouth shut, laddie. And I kept that close to my heart until the very last grudge match, local derby against Glasgow. And it was, I mean, we've been playing the same team for 4 years. And I stupidly opened my mouth.
Mum's the word for 4 years?
I didn't speak a word on the rugby pitch. Afterwards, you'd go for beers as you do culturally there. And then they're like, oh, you're English. We're glad we didn't find out. Anyway, I say something smart in my very last game versus Glasgow, and the team all just looked at me. And I was like, oh, and they actually had to sub me off. So I believe it. It's very true. It's this plummy English accent only gets you so far in life, and definitely doesn't work up in Scotland.
All right, so now I'm totally pissed that I didn't meet you at the party. Or maybe I did meet you. There were so many.
So briefly, but it was just a melange of people and good times. And
I'm kind of starting to look at you going, I think we talked briefly.
Very briefly.
We did, because we were talking about Paul. Yeah, we did meet.
Yeah. But
obviously, I know more of your background, because I love wine. I mean, you've got such an incredible story. So what year did you graduate? Like 2000?
I graduated my master's in 2003.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and straight after that, I got a scholarship into the L'Oréal School of Business Management.
Okay.
And so that's kind of like an on-the-job MBA program. And so it's multiple years. You go to, they normally only take candidates from Oxbridge, which is Oxford and Cambridge.
Yeah.
I was actually only the second person they've ever taken not to have gone to Oxford or Cambridge. And really what that does is that integrates you into their business. So you do 6 months in marketing, 6 months in sales, 6 months in logistics, 6 months in finance. And so what that does is they teach you all the core elements of business, and then you're put into either sales or marketing or finance. Well, I I go for marketing because that's what L'Oreal is very well known for.
Yeah, of course.
And it's a good start to it. And so they put me into what's called sensorial product marketing. And what that really is it's the beauty industry, so everything's sensorial.
Yeah.
But I was very, my first real job was helping, learning to become a trained fragrance nose and developing how to develop fragrances. So primary notes, secondary, tertiary notes, back end notes, and so on. And then moved through into fragrance, hair care, and skin care. I've worked in Paris and Clichy-Gare du Nord and in London. And so that job really kind of set the tone of the type of brand and product marketing I would do. And you mentioned wine. They wanted me to move to New York because I was one of the few that had an American citizenship.
Yeah.
And they wanted me to move to Fifth Avenue and start Maybelline Men, which is a makeup for men. Well, I'm a red-blooded 26-year-old, 27-year-old male at this point, and while the idea of Fifth Avenue...
From Montana, really, so makeup really Montana, isn't your...
Via Cambridge and Paris, yeah. To then go to New York and kind of grow my career within the beauty industry. Well, like I said, I'm a red-blooded male, and I'm not really sure if male makeup was for me. And so
you don't look too metro to me.
No, it's all right. I have fairly skinny jeans on. No, it's... But, and so from there, we parted ways and I joined, AB InBev was then United Carlson. It's now Asahi Brewing. And they owned a huge number of wineries in Napa. And so they hired me to be their head of innovation. So innovating into new wines, fortified spirits, new formats like cartons, single serve, plastic servings for raft and so on. And so I really moved from fragrance and beauty into the sensorial nature of wine. And it wasn't a big leap, really. And so it was really interesting and fun dragging that archaic wine industry into day times.
So I never thought of it that way. And when I look at your resume, I feel like I'm at the F1 of Monaco or something like that. You've touched a lot of bases and... in very sexy fields. First of all, you make complete sense because fragrances are all about sensory, right? And it's the endorphins that it revs up. Well, wine is all about the nose, the bouquet, the terroir, all that stuff.
The texture in your mouth, everything like that.
But what I never put the two and two together.
Yeah, and absolutely. And, you know, when I'm working in something like skincare or hair care, you have the tactile nature of the cream or the pearlescence of it. And, you know, quite often when you're buying a beauty product, you get really just to touch it once in store. You don't get to really try the product. And so you really have to sell the product on a shelf sensorially in about 4 seconds. Well, wine's the opposite. Wine, you can't smell or taste or touch anything. So it's about 90% on the bottle design and label design.
Yeah.
And so you have to turn that sensorial elements of the wine into a visual marketing for about 4 seconds while they look at the shelf. And that was, for me, was a huge challenge. And so coming up with new and different names, new and different bottle shapes, even the weight of a bottle. The more lead you put in the bottle, the heavier it is, the more expensive it feels. Whether you're using a raisin box label or a soft touch cotton label, it totally makes that product look and feel very different. And whether it's you're wanting to make it feel expensive or whether you're wanting to make it feel inexpensive but good value, it was a real challenge to do that kind of thing. And so that really got me into the product marketing side of things. And
okay, so hold on before you, just for a second, because it's so true. I love wine. I am not that smart about it, but our house in Arizona, we have a wine wall that's got 300 bottles, and I'd been collecting them for 10 or 15 years and forgotten most of the, and then we finish this house and I'm putting them away and I'm picking them up and I go, oh, that's a great chimney rock. That's a great wine. like I'm more about Napa wines and Walla Walla wines than I am European wines. Although we're going to Spain and Africa in September, so I'll obviously I've got a client who you should meet, who is I'm going to introduce you. He's from Dallas, and he's for four decades been doing high-end stone. And
I met him at the party.
You did meet him, Mark.
I did. Fascinating gentleman.
Oh, beyond fascinating.
Oh.
And his stories would blow you, like, you sit down with him, the more I get to know him. So we're going to Greece to one of his quarries because he's got a partner in Greece. So we're going to see the Parthenon and go underneath, which nobody can get to. But because they've been working on it for 10 years, we've got a green light. Anyway, I'm glad you met him. You really should connect with him about your projects.
Okay, absolutely. I'd love to. You know, we had a good chat because I've worked down in South Africa a fair bit as well. And I tend to try and break the winter up here by going down there for a couple of months.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Summer and the winter there.
Yeah, of course.
And so I tend to hide out in the wine country there, Franschhoek area and Stellenbosch. And down there, the wine, for the value, the wine is exceptional down there.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting, again, just a bit of a side note with the South African wine region, is they've been mismanaged the water from the winery area down into Cape Town. So there's a lot less water than there used to be as Cape Town grows. And so these wineries are uprooting 80, 90-year-old rootstock, putting on a truck and driving it 4 hours along the coast and replanting it that same day. And they're losing maybe about 12 to 15% yield, but they're basically moving to where the water is because it's been mismanaged.
Okay.
Well, what that means is you've got kind of the Western Cape region is shrinking and it's moving over to the coastal region, these old rootstocks, and they're splicing them, putting new varietals for cooler climates, more like Burgundian climates there. And so the evolution of the wine industry in South Africa is, it's fascinating right now. It really is.
Well, it's interesting because we've got a client in Naples and he's got a tree that's, I don't know, 150 feet tall at least on this property. And the home is about $250 million. They just finished it. It's the world's largest net zero house. Magnificent. Anyway, this tree was in Orlando. Disney was looking at putting it into their theme park. And this guy said, no, I want to buy it. So the owner bought it, but it was so big they had to cut it in pieces. Well, I didn't realize you could do that, but wine, you could graft in wine. So there's a technique, and you can only do it with certain trees, and this tree was one of them. So they cut it, and then they grafted it back together, sewed it, and then it just regenerated itself.
Cool.
Gee.
Never heard of it done on something big like that, but I mean, I believe it. Watching these viticulturists do this, and literally fields and fields, hectares of rootstock being moved just down the road to where the water is totally different on the other side of a mountain, it's been fascinating to watch over the years. It really has.
So getting back to your experience, so you went to L'Oreal,
yeah,
and then you went into the wine business. Just in Europe, or was it in Napa?
Yeah, so I guess I moved back or emigrated back to the US just before I turned 30. Once I left L'Oreal and moved back, and then I was working with wineries under the umbrella such as Beringer, Sapporo, Stag's Leap, not Stag's Leap Valley, but actually, or Cellars, but actual Stag's Leap.
Yeah,
and so
in there. Wine club member.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, it's hard not to. Etude. I would always recommend Etude Pinot Noir. Incredible wine from that company. Incredible. Yeah. But they have a large international portfolio. So Penfolds out of Australia, Wolf Trap, Matua out of New Zealand is the original Sauvignon Blanc from the Marlborough Valley.
Just an awful wine, by the way.
It's old and it's got a good name. Let's put it that way.
Forgive me for saying so are they part of the Constellation brand?
No, the Constellation is a competitor of the group I was in. And so, but really what that led me to was I was developing wines for the US market, but also we were then using that hub to then launch wines into Europe, the old world, which is a tough sell, and then into places such as Australia and South Africa as well. So we were designing and developing wines, but also we were navigating through the financial crash. And there's one thing that's tricky about making wine is there's a finite amount. You can't just turn the tap off or turn it on. And so here's a tidbit is that I will always buy and hoard wine during a recession, because what the winemakers do is they'll take a really nice well-known wine, but they don't want to lower the price of, I don't know, Silver Oak to $50.
Yep.
So what they'll do is they'll make less of the wine. They'll then blend it into one of their lesser brands. And so during a recession, I would always buy a bottle between $20 and $50 because it's normally the wine from the really top end, but they don't want to devalue the brand.
That's what Faust does with, what is the name?
Ferranante.
What's that?
Is it Ferranante, the Faust, their brand?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they do that, and they do it well. We navigated the big recession while I was there. And the one thing that doesn't go down when there's a stock market crash or a recession is booze. Booze always stays flat. If anything in recessions, it goes up a little bit. And so I felt that it was probably a good time to be in alcohol during the world, you know, the biggest recession of my career to date. And so that was a really interesting, time there. But I got kind of maxed out, we'll call it, with sensorial marketing. But there was still a need and a skill for it. And so I ended up going into management consultancy after that, and started joining large brands like Del Monte Foods as a consultant. And what we essentially, my remit was to then go in and much more of the business side, look at the brands, look at the products, and then prep those brands for sale. And so I worked specifically with Del Monte Foods on their pet food division, like a total like change from wine to pet food.
Right.
Now, trust me, that's not a sensory delight in any way, but
different.
But very different, because the consumer is an animal that you can't talk to, get feedback for, doesn't do well in a focus group.
Meow Mix gets my senses going, but not in the way that wine does or perfume.
Yeah, to give the listeners a bit of context, I was brought in to rescue the Meow Mix brand, to turn the brand around.
Okay.
It became known as the fast food of pet food, but it was one of the largest brands. It's a $500 million brand. That's a lot of kibbles to sell. And so the problem was it was
half cartoon, $1 billion,
half
just
a
in
billion kibbles
Meow Mix.
In just in Meow Mix kibbles. And they have a very small wet food division, but it's all kibbles.
Wow.
And people want that brand was evolving because pet food was becoming much more sensorial. All of a sudden it's, well, what do I want to eat is what I should feed my pet, you know, which is not at all what you should do. You know, you've got pictures of sweet potatoes and steak. It's not what they want, but it's what the purchaser thinks the consumer wants. And so the challenge with that business was the purchaser is different from the consumer, and the consumer doesn't give you any feedback. And that is a really tricky puzzle to solve.
Okay, so as I'm listening to you, and you've got a long story, and I want to get to Montana Bill, but I also want to talk about, first of all, you must be a master at questioning, because to create a focus group and understand who your customer is, you've got to ask a plethora of questions, right? The other thing that I want to ask you is, you've changed careers about every 4 to 5 years, and that's an art to pulling it off. And how do you get comfortable being uncomfortable or get comfortable with change, which is something most people aren't comfortable with?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think it might even come down to your original question of being uprooted from Montana and moved to a completely different continent, a completely different culture. I think that I've had to learn to get up to speed very quickly. I've had to learn to make friends and influence people very quickly. And really, that you can only do that around the world. And I've worked on four different continents by actively listening and trying to solve a problem. And if you just go about it by actively listening, trying to solve a problem, people will talk to you. They will talk endlessly to you. And so I think that that's really stood me in good stead. And it's interesting you mentioned, because we will get to Montana Bill, but all of this is relevant to what I'm doing now. Because, well, we'll get to that in a sec. But the last challenge, I think that the last piece in the puzzle for this is I have, as a contractor, moved every 4 or 5 years into either a different category or a different job or into a different continent. So after Meow Mix, the glorious heights of Meow Mix, I was headhunted by Blue Electronic Cigarettes.
Oh, this is fascinating when I read this.
This is an interesting chapter. So I was like, absolutely not do I want to work for Big Tobacco. There is no way do I want to move to North Carolina, Greensboro, and do this.
Well, do you smoke? Have you ever smoked?
Nope. But my mum did. And my mum did, I mean, for 50-odd years. No joke. And I made a bet with her that if I took this role to reduce the number of people smoking in the world, would she give up cigarettes? And she did. And to this day, she has not smoked a cigarette since, which was a deal. But the deal was with Blue, it's an electronic cigarette. So you can control the amount of nicotine. You can control the flavor. Well, what we did, which went the extra mile, was we built a tiny little microchip that went into the cigarette that Bluetooth to your phone. And so we knew when people were smoking, how long they would draw, whether it be a Canadian draw of 2.3 seconds or a French draw of 8 seconds. Like,
what?
That's an awful long draw. Yep. And so that means the cigarette will go down quicker in Canada than it will do in France. Same cigarette. And so all that data we got to capture on your phone and push to us. So really, it's a bit like Tesla. Sure, we're making cars or e-cigarettes, but really we're a data company.
Yeah.
And so we took all that sensorial stuff, the flavors.
Hold on, you've got to be kidding me.
And then we put tech in it. And so what we then did, which is why ultimately Big Tobacco came in and bought us, was we then came up with a consumer program to your phone, which ultimately weaned people off cigarettes, off white sticks, we call it. And so you would say, you'd send the repetitive text 2 minutes before they normally go for a cigarette, or a push text to a friend. That friend would text you and be like, don't go for a break. And that supported the community.
Stop it.
Yeah, the support of the community, basically. Well, look, I've seen my mum smoke for 50 years, and I was like, she does it at this time, when she needs a coffee, if she's had an argument, if she's done this, when she's done with work. And so it's either stress or being social, and so or routine. Now, we come up with this app and this program to reduce the number of white sticks on the market, and we're pushing it out, and it's working. In the average of 19 days, we're reducing the cigarette count to almost zero of people in the test
zone. Shut the front door.
And what scared... Well, the reason why we did it is because my remit, the reason why Blue brought me in, was they were like, look, we want you to launch this brand outside of the United States. Well, in Europe, you have national health services. And so actually, the only way you can really get buy-in is if you produce a product that the National Health Services will use as a tool to get people off cigarettes long term, because that will reduce the cost and burden on the government and the taxes. So we sold this program into all the Nordic countries, Italy, France, the UK. And so ultimately, you had all these people putting down white stick cigarettes, picking up this, and then 19 days, they're off our product and off the cigarettes. Well, fast forward, I'd say 18 months, and we have an aggressive takeover by Lorillard Tobacco for $2 billion in cash. They paid in cash to stop what we're doing.
And they squashed it.
They crushed. They bought the brand. They bought the brand, the patent, and they stopped it dead. They paid to do that. And so what's fascinating is we estimated we took about a billion white sticks off the market in 2 years in Europe alone. And then we were about to launch into Japan. And
China. Japan, they smoke like chimneys.
Oh, and exactly. And so they have a product which is basically heat, not burn, where you're heating tobacco, which doesn't give you the necessarily as many carcinogens. But once we rolled out the Asian plan into Indonesia, into Malaysia, Singapore, all these people smoke so heavily that the tobacco company was like, okay, we've had enough here. They bought us up, and then
Imperial... We hope your boys have had fun for the last 18 months, but we're done.
Oh, absolutely. So I built this company up. We had 44 employees in Edinburgh because I knew the city. That's why I wanted to start it. And so we had 44 employees there, and ultimately we wound the company down to one person, me, and I closed the door and moved back to Kalispell.
Done. You've got to be kidding.
It was a wild ride, and it was fascinating. I like to think that we did what we could when we could, but money talks in the end, and the main investors and the PE firm behind us were like, we'll take this buyout, thank you very much. And fair enough, a good bit of business. But
you did well. I'm sure you did.
I wish it's always the way, Ted. It's like, I wish I'd done more. I wish I'd done a better out of it. But, you know, for someone in England, yeah, I did very well for myself, thank you. But coming back to the States, I was just like, well, what do I do now? Really? I was like, okay. And I won't lie, I was a bit of a loss for about 6 months. I didn't know what to do with myself here. And then an old friend who was working at Applied Materials here in the Valley, in the Flathead Valley. So reached out to me. So Applied Materials makes capital equipment to make semiconductors. Nothing, I know nothing about it at all. And he literally phoned me up.
You didn't know anything about smoking either.
Nope, not at all. But I knew a lot about how people interact with sensory products and so with that, he goes, I hear you're bored. And I hear you're spending too much time at the bar at the Great Northern in Whitefish. And I was like, okay, fair enough. What have you got for me? And he said, well, I know you don't know anything about anything with capital equipment and semiconductors, but you can work with people well. I want you to move to Seoul, Korea, and rescue our Korean division of Applied Materials Packaging. He said, we used to do about 80 million. We do none right now. And
what?
I was like, you know, Ted, my first thought in my head was, well, I've worked in Africa, Europe, North America, Canada, I guess, included in that. But I've never had actually worked in Asia. And I was like, I'll get some Asian experience.
Seoul is fantastic.
Oh, I love it. I've spent enough time there. I had to do my taxes, but over there. But ultimately, what I learned in Korea is it was a pure relationship issue. You had big, gruff, bearded Montanans going over to Korea, and the Korean men, they want to see the whites in your eyes when you're doing work with them and when you're shaking hands. They want to hold your hand as you go around a factory tour because they are so thrilled to have you work there, over there. And they're gentle souls over there, but they're very tactile and they're very trust and relationship driven. Yeah. And so they were really struggling. The team was struggling here to connect with the team in Korea. And I was like, well, no one's going over there and actually being with the Koreans. They're going to work and coming back and staying at their Marriott hotel.
Yeah.
So I brought my team. We then really just started... I mean, not just going out, we were playing golf with the customers, we were meeting their families, we were going fishing with them, we would pick them up at the airports, and, you know, that builds such relationships and trusts, because these machines we're selling are $5 to $15 million. And, you know, quite a few people, when they're operating at that level and spending that amount of money, they're operating on fear. And so they don't want to screw up. They want, and so what you can do is, once you alleviate that fear, then you can really build trust by simply being good counsel and delivering on time what you said and on budget. And if you can do that, then you got them. And really, and it's not like just got them once. Like, we got repeat orders. In my 2-year stint there, I grew the business to $115 million from nothing, because they were just, they were loving the team and loving the new style of interaction. I still don't know what they do.
So they were, this company was doing $80 million, then it went to zero, and you got it up to $150 million?
Yeah. And that was in the space of 2 years. And it purely came down to the infrastructure was there. They were so close, but they couldn't sell correctly in. And these guys couldn't trust the folk out of here because culturally they weren't empathetic and being willing to work with them. So for me, like, and I worked to some degree in Japan as well, but that's very culturally different than Korea. And so I really want to focus in on the Korean side of it, or South Korean side of it, because it showed that it wasn't necessarily the product that they were buying. It was the relationship and trust and ongoing support. And so that for me was, that was a really interesting contract. It was a 2-year contract. And so at the end of it, thank you very much. And to your point now, I'm going to move on to my next venture, which was starting a clothing company in Whitefish, Montana, for a gentleman. I have a high net worth individual, loves to hunt. And he basically poached me away from Applied Materials and said, I want you to start me a Made in America hunting company. And I thought, apparel's apparel. And then I got into the category and I suddenly realized that these men are the most sensitive consumers I've ever worked with. They want...
hunters?
Yeah. Do you know why?
No.
Because they're killing things. Well, they're killing things, but to do that, that's the end part of it. But you've got the journey to get there. Ultimately, it's all sensorial marketing. They don't want to smell, otherwise they'll get winded by the animal.
Yep.
The material has to be quiet so that they can't hear them. So all then, you've got the two biggest senses there and then. Then you're developing camo for different situations. And you're using, I literally used an ungulate specialist and UW in Seattle to determine how the camos would work in different lights. Like, deer see yellow and blue almost like we see fluorescent colors. That's
how
why
do
you have
know to even ask those questions.
Well, again, it comes from asking from a point of sensory. And so, you know, like even the class, it's like very quiet zips and Velcro that doesn't make a noise. And it's like, if you're sweating, how do you stop that from smelling? Well, then you're putting antimicrobial in it. So then you're dipping the cloth in antimicrobial, then you don't ever smell of sweat, because that's the bacteria that smells. And so before we'd even launched this brand, Ted, COVID hits, and we have, I mean, like a million yards of ripstop nylon dipped in antimicrobial level 3. And we're going to go under because no one's buying anything in the, because of COVID. No one's buying hunting gear or anything like that.
I would think it would have been the opposite.
Well, I will get to that in a sec. So no one's, because it's made in the USA, what the challenge that we had was that we're trying to build all of this, everything from stitch to zips in the US. And that was taking a lot longer than we thought. And so we're going to go under unless we do something here. Well, we took that million yards of ripstop nylon and we made medical gowns for the front line, because that level of antimicrobial meant the frontline workers like surgeons and nurses could use it. And it could be washed and replaced, which solved the delivery and the supply chain issue. That all the hospitals run out of gowns, right? Well, with ours, you can wash them up to 400 times. So now all the hospitals have about 200 gowns in them, 50 of which are on the shelf, the others are in rotation. So if you ever have a pandemic again, you've already got the old ones that we've bought, given them or sold to them, sat in the shelves ready to go. You don't have to wait for them to come across from China. And so we sold that before we even launched the hunting brand.
I feel like I'm listening to Robin Williams come up with creative ideas while you're sitting there.
No one makes a sports apparel or technical apparel in the US. It's just not done anymore. And so the three-layer Gore-Tex, none of that's made in the US. And so during COVID and during the logistics crisis with China, we were actually the solution from a hunting perspective as well, because we were all made domestically. And so what we'd find was we could make a product in about 6 weeks. And normally, which means ultimately, if you're a North Face or a big company, you're designing, making and ordering your clothes from China about 18 months in advance. And so to your point, when COVID hit, this is a fun stat, in Montana alone, when COVID hit, 2,000 extra hunting and fishing licenses were sold. Not 2,000, 2,000% increase.
Okay, yeah.
So a huge number of people got into the outdoor industry.
Well, that's why I thought that it would have been good for you guys, not bad.
It was after a while, because COVID was in January, and hunting season's not all the way until October. Sort of October, November. Oh. And so in the meantime, we had to make money with the medical gowns. And so when hunting season hit, 2,000% increase in licenses, not a single extra buck, elk, deer or fish was recorded as caught by the FWP. Not a single one. Licenses, spike. Fish and game, nothing. So there weren't very successful hunters. So you get all these folk moving from the city. They want to live the dream and build into it. But ultimately, they weren't very successful. But I digress. So long story short is we launched this company. It goes really well. My contract, as I do, comes to an end after 2 years, and we part our merry ways. And so at that point, again, I'm like, I do pretty well. So at that point, I'm like, well, what do I do now?
But how do you give up all these babies? I'm thinking, you're like the surrogate. You deliver everything and then walk away. Don't you get emotionally attached to any of it?
It's interesting. The people in my teams, yes. The product, the money and the moneyed investors, no. Because I prefer to get in and out than have a long tail on a project.
Okay.
And that kind of, that's, I basically design, launch products and walk away into the distance. If you want me to, or recover products. If you want me to be a 30-year brand manager at Nike, I think that'd just bore me. I mean, it really would. We're changing the new colors this season, a different type of foam. I'm like, meh. So, and that was, and then, so I, again, I'm twiddling my thumbs, and then I get approached by a building company who want to grow, a building company in Whitefish. And so I start consulting with them, and because I've been here since on and off my whole life, I actually know quite a few people in the Valley. And so working with those guys for a while, and then we get on to finally what I'm doing now, which is I get a phone call from Paul McElroy.
Yes.
And he basically said, look, I want you to do for me what you're doing for our competitor, please. So I come and join Montana Bill.
He phoned
you? Mm-hmm.
Good for him.
And he's, you know, he's a shrewd businessman. He gets ahead of issues, which I think is why, you know, Montana Build is the only luxury fixed bid builder in the Valley, the only one. And that right now, with high interest rates and uncertain economy, is standing us in a really good stead, because people want a number and a date. They don't want cost plus. Everyone gives them cost plus, right? And that's fine. That's one model. And I would always encourage people buying a new house.
Yeah, but you don't know what the cost is.
Get a fixed bid, get a cost plus. Like, why not? But ultimately, when you have cost plus, the way the weather is here and the tricky things with trades, you're paying monthly. So there's no real incentive to get the project finished on a certain date, because you get to bill by month. So if it's a heavy snow year, oops, you're just going to have to, you know, it's out of our control, which to some degree it is. But Paul's visionary because he recognized that fixed bid is the way forward in this kind of flattening economy. And so he brought me in, and I was really pleasantly surprised. He has a bulldog team of analysts and accountants in the back there, because you have to bid on steel or wood that you might purchase 15 months down the line on a $5 million house. And so we're looking at, the analysts are looking at macroeconomics and economic indicators to see if steel and wood is going to go up or down. And so we kind of take the risk and hedge our bets. But it was really impressive to see a construction company run by the numbers in a way that it's run. It was fascinating. And so I'll link it all up together now, because I think that we've gone through a lot of my previous kind of experience, but how on earth should I be building a house? What really, like, why am I building houses right now? Well, the reality is whether I'm building a $5 million tool for Samsung in Korea or a $5 million home for a professional couple at the Lakeside Club or Yellowstone Club, is that ultimately you have the purchasers and you have the users, and there's a lot of emotion involved in the relationship there. And every single space in every single room in every single house we build is sensory driven. So I'm talking about the fixtures, the feel of the carpet, the feel of the textured wallpaper, the feel of the granite, the smell of the candles or the sandalwood that we'll use on a door frame, for example, the smell of the eucalyptus in the shower steam room. So what I've really brought, and Paul kind of enjoys, is that sensory aspect to the spaces that they build in their houses. And it's fascinating to talk with people on a 18-month build, because you come in, and to your point, I just shut up and listen. My biggest trait is I'm not going to tell you how to build or what you want. I'm a sponge. I'm going to listen to you, and I'm going to essentially talk you through everything and give you ideas to think about. And we're not full design build. We have some draftsmen in-house that take it through to a conceptual stage. But really, that's the stage where we're talking to the client and being like, is this your vision? Do we see it? And you're giving them ideas on spaces. And then we move it into, say, an architectural. And that's where, you know, the design magic happens, as it were. But I've run large projects and large businesses. And so my project management, I can do that. But a lot of the folk we're building houses for are CEOs of public companies, and they demand a certain level of management. And so, yes, you do want the salty guy with rough hands and a tool belt to build your house. But actually, behind the scenes, you want a bunch of accountants, yep, and very professional people that can operate on a similar level, also operate maybe with their spouse on their maybe a less or more professional level. And execute as they want, not as we want. And so it was really interesting to make that leap, because for most people, it's the biggest investment they're going to have in their whole life. And similar to those Korean gents, they operate often from a place of fear. And so what you want to do is listen and empower them, and then involve them at every stage into, is this how you envisage this? Because at the end, when we make this beautiful binder that we that shows the pictures and the grain of the wood and lists all the paints by room and the instructions on how to use the doors and the oven and the warranties, it's like we physically hand them like a binder to your new house, and we'll walk them through, and then we literally shut the door, and their finished house, they're there, they know how to work everything. And they've just been involved emotionally through the whole project.
What makes you say yes to joining a team, going to work? Like in this instance, what made you say yes to Paul? What was special? What was unique? What turned you on that said, you know what, I like this?
Sure. I think it's the fact that he's been operating successfully as a luxury residential builder in the Flathead Valley for 33 years. Now, that is difficult to do as a in the construction industry.
Yeah.
You know, projects bend noses sometimes, but some, and I can see now while I'm in the, since I'm in the door, why. But for me, joining an established luxury builder, when loads came in during COVID, they saw the boom and they came up. And to some degree, we're seeing that now with the Discovery Land Company coming in. A bunch of architects and builders are coming up from Bozeman, for example. Well, it's just a, it's a different market up here. He has an incredible network of subs, and he still gets local prices on a lot of things that a new builder or a new contractor in a new firm simply wouldn't get. And so for me, it was the longevity, and it was his vision, and it was his honesty. You know, he wants to be able to slow down a little bit. And that for me is, honesty for me is fantastic. So, right, let's work together. Let's learn. Let's do some solid handovers. You know, sunset to some degree as and when you want, you know, increase the beach time and decrease the office time. I'm fine with that because I get to absorb 33 years of Flathead Valley building knowledge, and he has built an exceptional team. And that would be the second thing I would say is, yes, they've been around a long time, but that team in that building is pretty impressive. Their longevity, the cohesiveness, the way they cross-functionally work with each other, and the way that they, to be honest, they're candid with the clients. You know, if they have to have a hard conversation, they'll grasp the nettle and talk to the client. And I think that people just really appreciate that candor nowadays. It's not, let's sweep it under the rug or let's hide this cost somewhere else. It's, hey, something unforeseen's come up, or hey, this change order is going to lead to a XYZ. And so they do a really good job of managing their clients.
So do you have a two-year contract with him?
I see myself, I am there full-time. I do not see myself on a short-term basis there. This really was kind of the move I was looking for, to stay in the valley.
Okay.
And not have to then go off into the distance again. You know, I would love to settle down sometime, even have the kids word at some point. So I can't be doing that, spending 180 days a year in a foreign country, let's put it that way.
Well, I just look at it, and the industry, we've been doing Build Magazine for 10 years. And Whitefish was our third book. Our first one was Bend. Then we went up to Canada because I'm originally from there. My wife's from there. We went out to Kelowna, BC, just outside of Vancouver.
Lovely. Yeah.
Then Canada's wine country. It's beautiful there. And then we went to Whitefish. And so Whitefish has been going a long time for us. And what we've learned about the industry, it's a fabulous industry. And the people are great. And so I look at you with all your experience, and at some point we all do want to kind of put some roots down. Now, you've had roots in the Flathead your whole life?
Mm-hmm. Whole life.
You know,
I still have friends here, people I knew when I was 5, 6 years old.
Isn't that bizarre?
It's just bizarre. It is bizarre. But I love it here, and it's such a special place. And talking about, you know, community, you know, moving to the UK, and that's kind of that tight-knit community. There's a difference. We have a fantastic community here, but in the UK, I call it a storm in a teacup. Over here, you have some space.
So you said something at the beginning of our discussion, and that is we're talking about the difference between the UK and America, whereas the UK, if you succeed, and the UK's got a class system, which most Americans don't even understand what that is, but it's very hard. If you're a welder, your kids are welders. Your grandkids are welders. It's tough to get out of it. And what you said is that they almost get jealous of you if you succeed, whereas in the States, they celebrate it, which is the American dream.
Yes, and that is no joke, Ted, why I decided to move back. I knew at the age of 15 I was going to move back. And that's why I went and did the career course I did, was because I knew I would go to get my master's, one job in Europe, and move straight back. So I had that level of education and one bit of European work experience. And it was purely because every time I came back, it wasn't why you had a plummy public school over there. It was genuine intrigue about it. And that I would come back and, you know, It was a joy to come back. Now, don't get me wrong. I do enjoy the UK. I love to visit. I like to leave it. And also, I always made a promise to myself that if I ever fly into the Flathead Valley and I'm not excited, I'd reconsider. And in the X number of years I've lived here, I've yet to have that. I still get excited when I fly into that airport.
Yeah, it's fascinating you say that. We travel a lot, and every time we fly into Phoenix, into Scottsdale, we get excited. We're in Bend, Oregon right now. We're excited to be back. We love the West, the whole West. I mean, I get excited, not the flight or the drive to go to Whitefish or Bozeman or Park City or anywhere out West, but once you're there, like Whitefish, we were there a couple of weeks ago for that party. Mm-hmm. We had a blast. And at some point, you got to talk to Dan if you've got a project that should be filmed. It should be on one of our videos that we do. I don't know if you've seen any of them, but we had one in Mayfair. Did over a million views.
Oh, nice. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with my marketing background as well, that content marketing and video marketing is... I really do understand that well. And so I'm really trying to implement a lot of that. Not just the pretty videos of completed houses, but really the raw behind the scenes, creating videos with the project manager walking around the house and him going, this shower was a nightmare, but look at how it turned out and why it was a nightmare. Or looking at working with our in-house interior designer and saying, why did you choose this color and texture scheme for maybe it's tile or furniture? And then really, you really get to understand the people behind the decisions there. And video marketing is just, it's of course where it's at. As long as we can keep AI from delineating really what's real and what's not, as long as we can recognize that, then I think we'll all be in good shape with it.
Yeah, it is a juggling act. There's no doubt about it. I've talked to so many people, and it's, you know, you look at all the executives, and I've really been studying this a lot lately, the executives of the social media companies, and you talk about technology, and you talk about our phones, and how much, you know, iPads are babysitters when people go out for dinner, right? And if you talk to the technology executives, most of them will say, my kids don't have phones, they don't have iPads, they're not allowed to. Yep. Because they know this is a great tool, but it's just one part. This COVID, if COVID proved anything to us, we need physical, I need to give you a hug or shake your hand, or 100%. I need icon. You talked about the Koreans, they want to see the whites of your eyes. We need this. We don't need to, mate, I got a quick question for you. I'll text you. Okay? I know you're busy.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I want to have a pint.
Yes. That's where it all happens. Yeah. And you've really hit the nail on the head there. It's funny you say that. I just got a new phone delivered today, and it's one of the dumbed down phones. It's a very simple call, text, and internet. That's about it. And for me, that will focus me so much more on doing what you just said, which is not just being head in the phone the whole time, but organizing real warm-bodied experiences and relationships.
I told our team, and this is a little bit more about us and not necessarily Montana build, but it's about everything in general. I was on a call this morning and I go, look at you guys, the only way, and I want to spend more time with you because I think we could connect and do some pretty cool things. And I've got a couple of people I want you to meet that are, you know, mid-40s. These are pretty forward-thinking builders in the space. And by having a, you know, the right group of people, all of a sudden it opens up so many different opportunities and doors. But what I was telling the team is this builder came over, and I'm going to guess he's 40, 41, 42, comes over for dinner. I got an architect there, an interior designer, because I like to put people together. And we're talking about the process when somebody builds a house. This is what most people do. They go online, they look for their builder, architect, interior designer, and then everything else they can think of. So audio, visual, windows, carpets, all this stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
An hour later, their head explodes because they've gone down so many rabbit holes, they're blowing up. So now they want to go to Fred's Appliances and open up or Waterworks and see the plumbing stuff. Now they want to touch and feel. And you're talking about sensory, which is everything in life, right?
It really is.
Everything. And so then I go, then they're going to see magazines and hopefully they pick up Build because they go, Build is the most beautiful and it's tactile. You feel the difference, right? Yeah. The design is all intentional. Everything's a two-page spread. Why? Because visually it's easier than looking at a Montana Build and a Pageant Woodwork, even though they're both great. Yep. And now they go home and have a pint or they have a coffee and they start getting ideas. And all we do is narrow the internet from the whole world to here's 50 to 70 of the top people in the Flathead Valley that can build your luxury home. That's it. So it's a combination. Now you know the websites to go to because... How many pictures do you take on this and you have no idea where those pictures are anymore?
Yeah, it's just scrolling through endless screen grabs and pictures.
So we've got to remember that AI is one thing. You know, the internet is one thing. All of these components, but at the end of the day, we still want to talk to people and have a pint because that's where everything gets done.
Absolutely. And it really is. And, you know, I think it's... that really shows in Whitefish right now. You know, we've got a beautiful office just outside of Whitefish City at Limits. You know, it's got a just incredible waiting room, conference room facilities. And we've really noticed a lot of that our competitors now are building custom buildings, not just for their offices, but so their clients can immerse themselves in their builder's brand and can see and feel samples in the house. They don't have to go to five different box stores. And really what we're seeing is these builders are curating like a sensory experience or a brand experience that their clients can immerse themselves in before they make a decision. And I just, you know, like I said, I've worked in luxury retail, and that's what the luxury fragrance brands have done for 50 years. And just seeing that in a category like building is, I think it's going to do wonders.
James, everybody wants good value. I don't care if you're a billionaire. You still want good value, right?
Yeah.
But you don't. You mentioned luxury brands. You don't see Prada or Gucci or Louis Vuitton or Bentley discount or Rolex discount anything ever.
No.
So what do you see when you see, you know, lighting stores are famous for everything's on sale all the time. Isn't that a race to the bottom?
Well, yes, we've got to separate price and value, because value is a perception and price is a number. And so if you take price out of the equation altogether and you talk about value, then you're having a completely different conversation. Because if you're trying to, for example, I don't know, the hard fixtures on doors throughout the house, if you want to do some cheap, if you're value driven on that, that cue, that cheaper handle will be what people remember more than all the value added things that you've added to your house.
Yeah.
And so I would always educate people that price and value are two very different things.
It's interesting. We put in our house in Scottsdale, we put Rocky Mountain Hardware, and it was, our builder said, it was about 6 times more expensive than just general hardware. Most of it's made in China. Rocky Mountain obviously is made in a foundry in Idaho.
Cool.
And my wife, every time she opens the fridge or opens a drawer and she's got that handle, she goes, I just love the feel and texture of this. It's, well, I even wrote it down that the difference between value and price. Price is just a number.
Yeah, and that what you're describing there is an emotion that comes from a sensation.
Yeah.
From a sensory. And so that, again and again over time, that will pay for itself in your mental and emotional state every year 10 times. And so we really do encourage, you know, we'll go down to the clasps and the whether we're screwing or nailing floors, right? So that there's, you know, with the heave and the temperature, we'll go drill down to make sure that the value, the perceived value in your mind of your house is where you want it to be. And that's where we really have to separate that.
Okay, so last question, because I could ask you a variety, but you got to go. And okay, you have told me some stories of some of the products, and the senses just kind of carried the sale, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to having a conversation with somebody and creating that difference between value and price. Mm-hmm. How do you do that so that it becomes an automatic as opposed to having to explain it in a little bit too much detail to someone?
Well, I think the key thing here is when I talk to someone about the spaces in their house, I have them quite often rank their spaces. So that what's your space? Like, is it the TV room? Is the kids' space the playroom? Is your wife's space her office? And then you have the key players rank those rooms. Then you then go essentially, okay, the bottom of this list is price driven and the top ranking elements of this list are value driven because you're going to use it a lot and that's your space, so don't sponge on it. But if it's the fifth spare bedroom bathroom, then on a sliding scale, that's probably going to be more price driven than value driven. And really, I just introduce it that way because everything has a price and everything has a value. And I really kind of turn it back on the customer and say, in this space in your house, where is this space on that spectrum?
Awesome. God, I just feel like I've been in school. I've been writing notes down so much.
Done a lot of listening over the years. Let's put it that way.
Okay, I'm going to let you go. James, you're awesome.
Thank you. I've had a good time, Chad. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being part of this episode of Friends of Build Magazine. Montana Build, Paul is a lucky dude. And to corral you long term is going to bode well for him and you. It's an incredible company that you've joined. And the future, I love hearing stories about companies that the founder, the visionary has a vision and then somebody comes and takes over and you want it to grow. You want it to push it to the next level. And there's no question you can do it.
I love it. I really appreciate the support. Thank you very much.
Hey, James, thank you very much. Thanks so much for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us some feedback. We'd love to hear from you. You can find everything discussed in this episode and more in our show notes below. I'm Ted Bainbridge, and you've been listening to Friends of Build Magazine podcast.